This is MSCI Perspectives, bringing to light insights and analysis that help global investors tackle today's challenges. I'm your host, Adam Bass, and today is June 18th, 2025. Those who know me know all too well my aversion to phrases like, now more than ever, unprecedented times, or this time is different from anything we've ever seen. And I'm not going to backtrack on that sentiment. But while the current macroeconomic and investment environments may not be unique, they are, at the very least, unusual. And as we've spoken about on this program before, commercial real estate, well, that's one story within investing that often does require its own chapter. And speaking of unique, our guests today, Jim Costello, Alexis Malton, and Brian Reed, who all work together on the Real Assets Research Team at MSCI, the three of them are uniquely qualified to help us flesh out the outline for that very commercial real estate chapter. I had the chance to speak with all of them earlier in the week. Here's that conversation. So Jim, Alexis, and Brian, first of all, thank you all very much for joining us. Let's jump in with you, Jim. 2025, to say the least, has been an uncertain year, especially when it comes to tariffs, but that's really not the only area where we've seen some concern. So if you could give us some context on where things stand in terms of commercial real estate and maybe a little bit about how we got to this point.
Sure. For commercial real estate, the thing that was interesting in the last few years of conferences, you talk to people involved in the sector, lenders, brokers, asset owners, there was a common theme that popped up. Stay alive until 2025. You had a situation where prices have been falling for commercial properties, and people understood it was a one-time shock from the high interest rate environment that suddenly came about. And there was a period of adjustment that had to happen. But once you get through that period of adjustment, if there's enough income, you might be able to kind of survive and have that asset continue to perform without ending it in some sort of a horrible situation of a foreclosure or default. But you know, when I've been at conferences this spring, the sense I've gotten from folks is that they feel as if the rug has been pulled out from underneath them, that they went through a lot of painful adjustments to try and keep assets cash flowing, keep everything together. But now we have this outside shock from everything on the uncertainty of tariffs, and it's throwing a lot of uncertainty into the real estate market itself. But that's where we're at. But so far, there's not the sign of the stress that might come. There's still just a lot of uncertainty and hand-wringing over it, in part because once there's a negative that hits the economy and hits the property, it hits the property market with a great deal of delay. Deals don't close overnight. Things that sold in the first quarter were already well underway. It takes, in some cases, up to 6 months for a property to go through the whole process of a manager deciding to sell it, a marketing phase, talking with different investors to see if they want to buy it. So if there's a negative reaction to the tariff situation, it's a little bit here and there in the market, a lot of anecdotes so far, but it would be more of a later in the year thing before it really has an impact.
So in light of that, Jim, how does an investor figure out what to do right now? Or do they?
Yeah, in terms of figuring out what to do right now, there's a couple things you could do. If I'm a buyer, I look at the environment we're in, and I just become more cautious, and I try to underwrite every potential deal that comes across my desk with a lot more downside risk. I'll underwrite every worst-case scenario, that maybe the income from the property falls tremendously, that maybe the debt situation, when I go to market and try and finance it, that it's not going to be very favorable for me. So if I happen to win the bidding process and I am selected as the final buyer of the property, that I have my downside risk covered. Now, of course, a current owner is not going to want to sell at every downside risk out there. And so the first sign of difficulty will really be buyers and sellers moving apart from each other, which will lead to lower investment activity. And through April, we still hadn't seen much of that yet. There were two sectors that saw a bit of a decline in April. That was the industrial sector and the hotel sector. And maybe there's some nuances in those sectors that could be interpreted as the canary in the coal mine. The hotel sector, for instance, income resets every day. So there's a little bit more information there. And industrial buildings are more homogenous. So that market tends to close a little faster than other asset classes. So maybe that's a sign of stress. But it's only 1 month. It's hard to see that. But the investors trying to make decisions off of it, part of it is that they've always had to work with a little bit of a backward-looking situation, always making decisions in part looking at the rearview mirror, because the information, despite all the efforts that we've had, the information isn't as timely as other asset classes. So the other approach that folks can use is sort of scenario planning, thinking about what happens if employment goes a certain direction, what kind of pricing would dominate, and outline a whole range of scenarios and then try to figure out where they'd be comfortable being an owner if some of the worst case scenarios played out.
And you've mentioned during previous conversations on this podcast that a lot of what goes on in real estate, a lot of the data gathering happens at conferences. And you mentioned during the preparation for this particular conversation that you recently moderated a Mortgage Bankers Association panel. So I'm curious, what were you hearing there in terms of changes in lending conditions, perhaps later this year?
This Mortgage Bankers Association conference, it's an interesting one because it's not just the lenders who are there. You have a number of borrowers. But the panel I moderated, the consensus of the participants was that this stress and uncertainty that people are talking about, it hasn't hit the debt portion of the capital stack full force yet. People are noting that there is still debt available. And if we look at our own data, the originations data that we track, it's still kind of preliminary, but the first quarter data was still up from a year ago. Now, it was down from the fourth quarter, but some of that's seasonal. And if you look at the Fed flow of funds data from came out last week on the stock of debt in the economy, yeah, it was down a little bit from the fourth quarter. But again, there's some seasonal patterns there. So it's hard to say if it's really had an impact yet. But, you know, these people were talking about that there's still debt out there. It's just much more expensive than in the past. And so that starts to play into, you know, what we mean by the availability of debt, because some people will read the higher cost of debt by simply saying, oh, there's no debt available. But what they really mean is there's no debt available at a price that I'm willing to pay. And so that price element has a certain element of the liquidity in the debt markets that matters. Because if the current owners are willing to sell at a low cap rate, but all the debt cost is higher than that cap rate, it's going to be hard to make anything close in the marketplace.
Alexis, at this point, I'd like to bring you into the conversation. Jim mentioned the data around lender activity. I know you've taken a deeper look there. What is the data telling us?
On the whole, lenders were really quite active in 2024. Our Mortgage Data Intelligence database recorded nearly a 20% increase in origination volume in 2024 compared to a year earlier. And that was really a function of two groups. So these two groups were the predominant source of growth in new loan volume, the first being CMBS, and the second being investor-driven lenders, which is how we refer to non-bank lenders like debt funds. And these groups' growth was really at the expense of traditional banks. Bank originations were down nearly 20% year over year, and that really reflects their more conservative stance amid increased regulatory scrutiny. As Jim mentioned, the preliminary data for the first quarter of 2025 indicates lending activity has remained strong. Investor-driven lenders in particular have shown no signs of slowing, And this group really tends to be more opportunistic and have flexibility in structuring deals when you compare them to traditional lenders like banks. And that's going to be especially pertinent in a climate where owners may need to be a little bit creative in financing.
Are you seeing any, when you look at this data, any shifts in the types of loans that these lenders are looking to or willing to underwrite?
So we don't see drastic changes in lending standards when you look at the year-over-year data. But when you compare the loans that are coming due in the current period, there's certainly a significant shift towards more conservatively underwritten and more expensive debt. If you look at commercial loans currently coming due, those were originated at an average 68% loan-to-value ratio with interest rates in the low 4%. And today, on average, we see new financing closer to a 57% LTV with rates at around 6.5%. And that's really the story across both commercial and multifamily assets.
Based on other periods in history, does it seem like perhaps those conditions tighten even further?
I think it's a little bit of a wait and see. We certainly have lenders like those investor-driven lenders who are more than happy to work with borrowers and jump in where there may be a gap in the marketplace. But of course, that's not going to be the case for every asset. There's certainly assets that are not cash flowing, and you know, no lender is going to jump in if they don't think that they're going to get paid back.
So Brian, both Jim and Alexis have talked a bit about investor-driven lenders, as we call them at MSCI, and their role in the origination rebound late last year. So what has that meant in terms of fund performance for these lenders?
Investor-driven lenders, particularly debt funds, have definitely played a key role in reigniting origination activity. A big part of that is that, unlike traditional lenders, these funds are less constrained by regulatory barriers and legacy portfolios. And so that flexibility has allowed them to move quickly and jump in to perceive gaps in the market and deploy capital quickly. And so that's sort of underpinning that spike in activity that both Jim and Alexis talked about. As a result, their funds, especially those with distressed or high yield mandates, are showing strong performance at the moment relative to both traditional debt and equity strategies. And if we look at past trends, the 2010 and 2011 vintages for debt funds actually performed quite strongly. So those were obviously funded right off the back of the financial crisis. And it may well be that, again, here where we've been through a period where repricing has met capital scarcity, that funds that have deployed well in this recent environment will also benefit to quite a big extent.
You have a chart that you use from time to time that highlights the relationship between deal volume and returns, where deal volume kind of follows returns. Can you talk about that a bit and talk about if that kind of relationship holds, what that might mean for deal volume?
Yeah, there's probably a bit of a both-way causality there, in the sense that when the market is doing really well, people are more motivated to jump in and transact. And so higher returns probably help support higher deal volumes. But then similarly, the amount of people bidding on deals is going to be very contingent on, is going to have a big impact on pricing. And so if you have a market where there's lots more people actively looking to buy, it's going to help drive prices up. So if we see transaction activity remain relatively stable, that's probably a good sign for performance. But if transaction activity doesn't recover or it declines, then that's a downwards pressure on performance.
And when we look across, or when rather you look across different strategy types, how are debt funds positioning themselves? What are some of the nuances?
Yeah, I mean, much like in equity investing, where you have a spectrum that goes from core to core plus, value add, opportunistic, with debt, there's a risk spectrum as well. Some investors will prefer the relative security of senior lending. Others will look at moving up into mezz debt or even distressed debt strategies. And as you move across that spectrum, you're going to see a lot of change in terms of the nature of the lending, as well as the expected performance profile. Of late, the distressed debt funds have seemingly done very well. I think that's really the result of them being able to take advantage of some of the dislocation in the market with the sort of debt walls that have been around, the pressure from higher interest rates. It's really created accretive entry points for those kinds of lenders. Whether that enables them to sustain outperformance will obviously depend on how the macro economy evolves over time, but it's been quite beneficial in that part of the spectrum. Whereas in other parts where lenders are maybe a little bit more exposed, say mezz debt, there's perhaps been a little bit more pressure.
And so what you mentioned about distressed funds, I'm curious, based on what Jim was talking about at the top of the conversation, that we haven't really seen the signs of stress yet. So maybe it's just me, but how does that square?
Distress is the opportunity that these funds are taking advantage of. They've capitalized on dislocation and stepped into situations that others couldn't underwrite.
You know, I'd also hasten to add what Brian's talking about on the distressed debt funds. A lot of that was already in place in 2023, 2024. People looking at loans from those periods and rolling it into those funds. The problems I was talking about was in relation to the tariff world and the changes that have come about from that. If any of that rolls through into the distressed debt market, it hasn't happened yet. It's going to take time for that to happen. So it's almost as if we have different waves of problems and challenges that the market is overcoming. And it's hitting us much faster today than the real estate market can react.
Thank you both for clarifying that. Definitely makes sense that just because we're seeing distress funds act differently doesn't necessarily mean it's because of the current distress, especially in real estate markets. So the other issue that you've all sort of mentioned in passing that I want to focus on now is, right, we love to look back at history for lessons. And again, in the conversations leading up to this recording, Jim, you mentioned specifically how even though prices have declined sharply since interest rates started going up in 2022, we really haven't seen what you would call a collapse like we did in 2008, 2009, the global financial crisis. So what's different this time around?
Sure. And you have to ask me that question as well, because I'm so old. I was there then. I was there around the SNL crisis, the Asian financial crisis. So all the, and I've survived.
Well, I didn't
a few
want to say, but yeah.
But here's the thing. Every one of these downturns, there's a lot of factors that rhyme in every downturn in terms of people see a big run up in prices and a big decline in prices. And so they think that, oh, well, this worked last time. I'll just repeat it this time through. I can't tell you the number of pitches I saw in the financial crisis where people thought that, oh, I'm going to be the next Sam Zell. I'm going to do everything he did, and I'm going to buy everything on the cheap and ride the recovery. Or people who have said, oh, I'm going to be the next Jonathan Gray. I'm going to start a fund and go after distressed notes and then ride the wave of recovery. You know, there's only one Sam Zell, only one John Gray. You can only be yourself and pursue your own strategy. And the way to be successful is look at what factors drove the downturn and what structural issues are different from this one versus previous ones. And with respect to the financial crisis, the run-up to the financial crisis really was a risk situation of a near monoculture of debt. Now, we don't have any data going back then. We started tracking loan originations in 2012, but talking with people active in the market, it seemed that the CMBS market was maybe 60 to 70% of the market at the time. That's how aggressive the conduits that originate the debt that gets sold into the CMBS securities. That's how aggressive those folks were. And that situation where you have basically one type of lender, it was so intense that life insurance companies, I was approached by one client at my last position, asking me to help them with a research piece to justify the need to still have life insurance lenders in the market. That's how intense the process of competition was. But that's different than today. Once CMBS stopped originating, for many folks, debt was not available at any price. And when you take away 60% of the capital stack, you're going to have a bad day. This time through, in the run-up to the 2022 interest rate shock, we had a much more diverse lending environment underneath. And so the way to think of it, if you're sitting on a stool and it has one leg, and someone comes along and kicks that one leg out from underneath you, it's going to end in tears. If we have many legs on the stool and one falls out, you know, the market can still be stable. And so that's one thing that's different. And it makes for a more competitive situation today with other lenders out there. CMBS 1.0, the way it was written, when you had a bad loan, if you had a default for some reason, there was no working with someone on the other side of the transaction to kind of re-engineer the deal, rework it, figure out some other way to structure the payments. You'll get that if you work with a bank or a life insurance company where there's a relationship-driven lending pattern, but you don't have that in back after the financial crisis with the version one CMBS world. So within 12 quarters of that, of the start of the financial crisis, we were at a peak level of distressed asset sales because everybody was just forced into foreclosure. This time through, it's a death by 1,000 cuts. Even if there's distressed buildings, it's taken a long time to move through because people don't want to take the hit right away if they don't have to. But between those two cycles, the other fundamental thing that's different is that in the financial crisis, the nature of distress was financial distress. It was an asset that was otherwise cash flowing that, you know, somebody put a 95% LTV loan on, so a little bit of a price decline and you're wiped out right away. This time through, it's fundamental distress. It's a dead mall in Ohio with burnt tile and orange carpet from the 70s with deferred capex. It's a mid-block office building in Midtown Manhattan built in the 50s with deferred maintenance. It's issues where someone needs to swing a hammer, and that's different this time through. It's not a bunch of suits from New York flying in and putting a new capital structure on the building. You need somebody who knows something about the physical nature of real estate to make some of these assets survivable.
And you mentioned the stool analogy. Who are some of those new lenders?
Well, what's been interesting in this market since the COVID crisis, Alexis and Brian both talked about them a bit. The private credit world has grown tremendously. The debt funds. We also call them the investor-driven lenders. It's private capital going in where, you know, the banks are unwilling to lend at times. There's less regulatory burden on these, but, you know, it gives them access to some real estate performance at a high rate of return. High meaning it's positive compared to the MSCI ACOE. Until recently was negative. So if you're a fund investor, you're looking at that, you think to yourself, I just want to invest in the debt because at least I get something back. So those debt funds grew quite a lot, but they're still not like even a quarter of the market. There's still much more diversity there than in years past and certainly in the run-up to the financial crisis. But those groups have typically been the most aggressive and, doing deals that others won't.
Brian, when you look at the risk return profile, does it still look attractive for investors in terms of these funds?
Yeah, generally, I think the risk-return profile at the moment seems to still be relatively attractive to investors, but it's obviously not necessarily for everyone. The market is still in transition, and that means that there's still real risk, but also real opportunity for investors who can commit to some of these more liquid debt strategies and partner with the right partners. There's theoretically a lot of upside that they can realize, especially in some of those distressed debt strategies that we were talking about. But then again, there's also real risk there that investors need to be mindful of.
So Alexis, given this fact that debt funds are willing to take on different types of loans than traditional lenders, can you walk us through what are some of the implications of that?
So what we do see is that investor-driven lenders tend to be a bit more risky with their lending than some of the other lender groups. Brian kind of phrased this perfectly earlier with they generally just have lower regulations than other lender groups do. And what that means is they're able to provide larger loans at higher LTVs, and generally the highest LTV that we see across all of the lender groups. They're often underwriting larger loans and are willing to go higher on leverage. One of our recently published research pieces looked at which of the loans coming due in 2025 were underwater. And what we mean there is the current value of the underlying asset has fallen below the outstanding loan balance. I don't think it would be shocking to anyone to know that the office sector has the largest share of underwater loans. Most every other traditional or core asset class had around a 10 to 15% amount of loans that would be underwater, and office was double that. What we also see there is that lenders with the most exposure to those underwater office loans are CMBS and investor-driven lenders. For CMBS, their exposure is largely a function of the share of the office market that these lenders have historically provided. Additionally, their 10-year loan term also lends itself to loans coming due in the current year. So definitely seeing the pain where you would expect it. I think the apartment sector was the other one by value where we saw a significant number of loans underwater, but that again is just a function of how large the apartment market is.
So before we wrap up, folks, I'd like to do a bit of a round robin if we can, and have everyone take a crack at this one. You know, we always try to look ahead a bit if we can at the end of episodes. So with everything in mind, all of the wonderful insights that you've provided, if we're looking ahead for CRE investors, what might they be watching as we move into the second half of 2025? And, or perhaps, what will you be watching for? Jim, let's start with you again.
Good question. You know, I'm looking at particular points in the calendar, just the structure of the market and the way it evolves when you get people together at certain points in time on the calendar, certain conferences. In the fall, there's the Urban Land Institute Conference. It's the biggest commercial real estate conference across all asset classes in North America. You get all the developers, investors, managers, all in one place. And you'll get kind of a consensus coming out of there of where the fall transaction market will be. And that's an important market to watch, because there's a huge seasonal pattern in commercial real estate investment, with the fourth quarter of every year being the biggest quarter as everybody rushes to kind of get all their allocations put to work for the year. So the everything coming after Labor Day, conference season starts up big, and you'll really get a sense of momentum at that point. That's one I'll be looking for. In the meantime, I'm just looking at the monthly transaction activity that we put together to see if anything else breaks yet. The April data, you know, we saw some weakness in industrial and hotel. Everything else is still growing. We'll be watching that in the coming months over summer to see if there's leading indicators of more stress to come this fall.
Random pick, Brian?
So if we cast our minds back to the end of last year, I remember having conversations with clients where the outlook was pretty rosy. I think we'd been through a period of difficulty adjusting to the higher interest rate environment, but there was a sense of optimism that this inflation was going to continue, that economic growth would remain robust, and that as a consequence, we'd probably see a reduction in the interest rate environment and a pickup in transactional activity that would essentially help kickstart the real estate market again. And that mantra that has been mentioned, survive until 25, was sort of everywhere. That has now really adjusted to survive through 25. We are dealing with a lot more uncertainty now, and a lot is very contingent on what happens in the economy. Real estate is a growth asset class. The cash flows that underpin both debt and equity investments for real estate are sensitive to growth. So looking to those macro indicators, I think, is going to be key for understanding how the asset class is going to perform. We've definitely seen a big shift in investor perceptions and expectations. When you look at the PREA consensus forecasts for the real estate market, the latest figures that have come out have shown a big increase in the downwards pressure on expectations in the near term. But over the longer term, there's still a sense of optimism that growth will return.
And last but certainly not least, Alexis, what will you be watching for as 2025 continues?
So we do track and report on distress in the market. And one of the things that we picked up on in the first quarter of this year was a shift from what we'd been seeing previously. Since 2023, what we had seen was new instances of distress slowing in each quarter, meaning that every quarter, the value of distress entering the market had been less than the prior quarter. And that really stopped in the first quarter, and we saw distress start to grow. So what I'm interested in is that a trend? Was that a one-off? Are we going to start to see some pain bleed through from the tariffs? But just a better picture of really where we're at with distress.
That's all for this week. Our thanks to Jim, Alexis, and Brian, and of course to all of you for listening. You can find more insights on commercial real estate on the Research and Insights section of MSCI.com. Next up on the program, well, Joe and I will be roasting hot dogs and watching fireworks for Independence Day here in the States, but we'll be back later in July with an exclusive conversation between MSCI's Chief Research Officer, Ashley Lester, and Axel Killian, MSCI's Head of Client Coverage. Until then, I'm your host, Adam Bass, and this is MSCI Perspectives.